In Esther chapter 1, the king of Persia, Ahasuerus, deposed his wife. He deposed her from her role as queen after she humiliated him at a banquet. He had given her instructions to come and appear at the end of a very lavish party that was being thrown for the city of Susa, which was one of the main capitals in Persia. This happened in 483 BC when this queen resisted him. And sometime after that, a search began for her replacement. In Esther chapter 2, we learn that all the beautiful young virgins of the 127 provinces of Persia were being gathered together. This was at the advice of the advisors to King Ahasuerus. They are setting the terms and the criteria about how the king's wife might be replaced as queen. And these women who were gathered together from all of these provinces were to undergo a season of beautification and preparation for a night of sexual relations with the king. The king's advisors had suggested that the one who pleases the king the most should become the queen. Well, in that chapter, we're also introduced to two characters who are key for the rest of the story, Esther and Mordecai. They are Jews outside the promised land, living in Persia. It seems that Mordecai is in a particular administrative or at least divine or kingly sanctioned role as he works and serves at the king's gate, probably to serve in some sort of security form or a distant advisor to the king and the matters that are there. We do find that in his role, he overhears a conspiracy against the king later in chapter 2, and he makes it known to Esther so that the king could be spared. This is the kind of thing Mordecai would do at the king's gate. Also in this chapter, though, it turns out that Esther is one of the young, beautiful virgins who are gathered for a night with the king. And she went along with the proceedings of beautification and preparation until her night arrives. She ate food, which would have violated the commands and the law of Moses, which were about clean and unclean food. And she spent a night with the king and engaged in fornication and therefore in sexual behavior the Lord prohibits. Then she married this pagan Gentile king at the end of the chapter, which was something Scripture directly prohibited as well. Strangely, all along the way, she intentionally concealed the fact that she was a Jew. She did this at the direction of Mordecai, who did not want it known that they were Jews. This is strange. It's suspect behavior for this kind of concealment, because a prior king of Persia had allowed all the Jews to return to the promised land and for a time of peace. Historically, and even within the biblical narrative up to this point, there was no persecution of the Jews happening. And so the concealment of the identity and ethnicity of Mordecai and Esther should raise the awareness of the reader in such a way to think, what is it that they're trying to conceal and why? Why is it that they don't want to divulge who they are and to live according to the regulations of the law? Well, chapter 2 ended with Mordecai hearing about a plot to assassinate the king. He gets the message to Esther, who tells the king, and the conspirators are then executed. Mordecai, however, was not shown any favor, which was strange because in the kingdom of Persia especially, people who did what would be favorable actions in the king's view were rewarded, vindicated, promoted in some way. Instead, we read in chapter 3 that Haman is promoted and not Mordecai. We are introduced to this figure Haman, who turns out to be the villain of the story. Haman is called an Agagite, and this ancestry taps into a biblical rivalry many, many years in the making. Agag, many years earlier, had been a king of the Amalekites, and apparently Haman is a long descendant of this early king who was part of the enemies of Israel. The Amalekites were those who wanted to quickly and very recently out of Egypt begin to attack the Israelites in Exodus 17. We do find that later on in the history of Israel, when God brings Saul to be the king of Israel in 1 Samuel, he tells Saul to destroy the Amalekites in 1 Samuel 15. But Saul does not utterly destroy them. Saul's identification is interesting because in 1 Samuel 9:1, he is called a son of Kish and of the tribe of Benjamin. And it turns out that Mordecai in the book of Esther is also a descendant of Kish and of the tribe of Benjamin. So it looks as if in the big story of the Bible, this rivalry between Haman and Mordecai is actually an individual representation of a much lengthier rivalry in the history of God's people between the Amalekites, the enemies of God, and the people of God, or between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman, going all the way back to Genesis 3. Therefore, there are cosmic realities at work in the book of Esther. These faces and these characters in this story are part of something that's been unfolding for some time. And while Saul much earlier did not destroy the Amalekites, much later now, Haman from the Amalekites wants to destroy all of the Jews in the province of Persia. How is this going to result? What will be the outcome of such a plot? We realize the plot was hatched because of Haman's animosity toward Mordecai in particular. Why was such animosity shown toward Mordecai? Well, initially, Haman is promoted, and perhaps this provokes some envy in Mordecai, or perhaps Mordecai knows that Haman is a descendant of Agag and therefore does not want to honor him or show any deference to him whenever Haman passes by. Everyone else sort of bows in courtesy and honor of the position that Haman has been promoted to, but Mordecai refuses. The other people at the king's gate don't know why until they press him and press him and press him, and he ends up saying, "Well, I am a Jew." And the people at the king's gate let Haman in on this very juicy bit of information. Haman is so angry that he plots not only against Mordecai, but against all of Mordecai's people, the Jews. And so in chapter 3 of Esther, where we ended, Haman has determined by lot that the day of destruction of the Jews will be 11 months later, on the 13th day of Adar, the final month in the Jewish calendar. The timing of the edict toward this destruction is also interesting, because when Haman gives out the edict that this be done 11 months later, the edict is passed, or at least formally signed, and has begun to be passed the eve of Passover. And we should remember what Passover represents. Passover represents the people of God under threat from a foreign power, where you had the people of God facing oppression, perhaps even enslavement and death in the years to come, depending on how wicked the Pharaoh was going to be. And yet, God delivered them from Egypt, and they began to remember with Passover that wonderful deliverance. Well, now it's as if things are happening again. A foreign power seems to be rising against them, and the Persians, stimulated by Haman's animosity toward Mordecai, are going to go against the Jews. So now, while Passover is coming, and while the feast of Passover and the days ahead would normally be marked, they're going to be weighed down and burdened mentally and spiritually with the knowledge that once again, they are under threat. Will God deliver them like he did so many years earlier from the Egyptians, like he recently did from the Babylonians, and now the Persians are the foreign power that is a threat? In verses 1 to 3, look at the mourning of Mordecai and the Jews. It tells us that when Mordecai learned all that had been done, now how did he learn about this? Well, because in verses 13 to 15, at the end of chapter 3, there was not just one copy of the king's edict that was sent out for people to eventually circulate and get their hands on. They had letters that were multiplied for all of the provinces, written in all of the relevant languages that people speak, to get the word out about what was coming several months down the pike. Well, here in chapter 4, Mordecai learns about this, probably from the same way that other people do. And I want you to think about the scene that's being described here. When he had learned, he tore his clothes, he put on sackcloth and ashes, and he went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. Now, I sort of imagine a director of a movie, you know, having a very distant shot of Mordecai sort of coming out, holding this letter in his hand. And then all of a sudden, the zoom in begins. And as you see Mordecai, he's walking. He looks disheveled. His clothes are torn. He sort of looks like he's walking in a fog. And he's just sort of staggering, probably bumping into people as they go past him. And he gets to the middle of the city, and he just begins to scream. What a scene this is in verse 1. The scene is of this man who is absolutely undone. He had earlier helped deliver the king from an assassination by pointing out to Esther the conspirators and what they were planning, which ended in those conspirators being executed. And now Mordecai, he and all of his people are under threat from this man Haman. And not only that, you could argue from a reader's perspective that Mordecai bears some responsibility in the way things have unfolded, because he himself has so outraged Haman with refusing to bow as Haman would have expected him to. And so Mordecai feels undone, not just because he's now in Haman's sights, if you will, but all of the Jewish people are in Haman's sights. And so he's staggering to the midst of the city. He is wearing garments of mourning and contrition and repentance, just like what you would see filling the Old Testament in earlier books, sackcloth, ashes. This symbolizes a people undone. This symbolizes mourning and distress. It can also symbolize somebody's contrition before the Lord, hoping he will intervene to deliver them from whatever they are facing. And he cries out with a loud, bitter cry. It tells us then in verse 2, he leaves wherever he is in the midst of the city, and he goes up to the entrance of the king's gate. And the reason he can only go up to the entrance of the king's gate and no farther into the king's gate is because no one's allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. Now, the only people who would most likely be mourning the edict would be the people of the Jews above all. So Mordecai is, in a sense, beginning to give himself away as to who he is. Not because nobody else in the land will probably care that the Jews are destroyed, but because above and beyond anybody who would care about the Jews being destroyed would be the Jews. And so here, Mordecai is undone, and he doesn't really care who sees it. This is different, isn't it, from earlier when he wanted to conceal any knowledge that he was a Jew. Could this signify a shift inwardly in Mordecai? I would suggest it does. And we see a coming shift within Esther as well. That in just a moment, though. Not only is Mordecai donning these garments, look in verse 3. In every province, wherever the king's command and decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews with feasting and fasting. Right now it's just fasting and grief. Weeping, lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. This should feel reminiscent of Old Testament stories where God has warned of coming judgment, so to speak, and the people of God are pleading and crying out and lamenting and donning sackcloth and ashes. It represents a kind of communal grief that they are all sharing in. And again, this kind of thing gets noticed, right? This is not something done in the privacy of somebody's home. It seems that there is open fasting, weeping, lamenting. People are laying in sackcloth and ashes. Mordecai's at the king's gate dressed like this. Then verses 4 and 5, the concern and curiosity of Esther is noticed. Verses 4 and 5. Because it seems that at this point, at least, Esther is unaware of this edict. That's a strange twist in the story. You would think that she would probably check her mailbox just like everybody else does pretty quickly and get a hold of this letter. But for however much time has passed between the writing of this edict and Mordecai and other Jews finding it out, Esther has not yet found out what's happening. So in verses 4 and 5, it tells us that Esther's young women and her eunuchs, they come and tell her. Now, what is it that they've told her? Well, Mordecai is at the king's gate, and Esther and Mordecai have had the opportunity to communicate in earlier parts of the book. And so it's probable that the people associated with Esther have noticed Mordecai. And he doesn't look well, okay? They've seen him in better straits. He's in ashes and sackcloth. So Esther is confused by this. And out of the kindness of her heart, and because she's deeply distressed, she sends him some clothes. In verse 4, she sends garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. This means she has not processed or is not aware of what the grieving Mordecai is provoked by, and what all the other Jews would be grieving and lamenting because of. So in verse 5, Esther called for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed to attend her. And she ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why. Do you see the ignorance that she's admitting here? She doesn't know what he's doing or why. And so we have to give Esther some space here. She's not saying, oh no, Mordecai, I know the edict reads terribly, but you shouldn't be mourning or lamenting. She doesn't know about it yet. So in verses 4 and 5, she's sending sackcloth. He says, no, thank you. I don't need other clothing. I'm dressed this way for a reason. And she sends a go-between named Hathach, who's going to essentially get from Mordecai this information. He's going to learn why this was and what this was. And in verses 6 to 17, the communication between Esther and Mordecai continue. In verses 6 to 17 here, here's something to note. Esther and Mordecai never have a face-to-face conversation in the verses we're about to read. Esther and Mordecai are communicating to each other through an intermediary. The intermediary is going back and forth between where Esther is staying with other young women and the king's gate where Mordecai is. You don't know the distance in feet or any sort of spatial estimate for how far he had to travel, but this intermediary is going back and forth in the verses to come. So look in verses 6 to 8 where we see Mordecai's explanation for Esther. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Now, Hathach no doubt identified himself, no doubt said, Esther has sent me, and no doubt has said, why do you look like that? And what is going on with all of the other Jews? Esther needs to know. In verse 7, Mordecai tells him everything. It says Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. So Mordecai tells him about Haman. He tells Hathach about the refusal to bow to Haman. He tells Hathach about how Haman found out, was enraged, and now plotted. He tells about how Haman used the king's authority to issue a death sentence against the Jews. Mordecai shares how Haman promised to compensate the king's treasuries to destroy this certain people, the Jews. And so Mordecai just spills everything, right? Then in verse 8, Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her. But then he goes a step further. I want you to see what Mordecai's willing to do here. Mordecai wants Hathach to convey the following. Tell her to go to the king, beg his favor, and plead with him on behalf of her people. So this copy of the decree is not just for Esther's information, but to introduce an urgency into Esther's status as queen. She's to go to the king and plead on behalf of her people. And I take this to mean, not only is Mordecai not caring any longer if people realize he's a Jew, he wants Esther to make her identity known to the king as well. Because if she's going to go and quote unquote plead on behalf of her people, then it's going to become clear in short order that the people the king has allowed Haman to issue a decree against, it's the people of his queen herself, the Jews. Now again, in Esther 3, the Jews were not named as a people. Haman had kept that ambiguous. There's this certain people. They're not to your prophet. They don't follow your laws. You need to just destroy them. And the king's like, okay. You know, he seems to constantly just be led along by other people in the book of Esther. It's really tragic. It doesn't take a lot of leadership and initiative. He's just being led along. And there in Esther 3, we realize Haman is not ambiguous. He wants to kill the Jews. And so with the king's authority, he issued that decree. This means Mordecai wants Esther to read the decree and then be so distressed by it that she's willing to make known her identity. This is different than Esther 2 verse 10, where Esther had not made known her people or kindred because Mordecai had commanded her not to. This is different than Esther 2:20, when Esther had not made known her kindred or people as Mordecai commanded her. For Esther obeyed Mordecai just as she was brought up. So this disclosure is a transition in the story's plot. The concealment is now going to be disclosed. In verses 9 to 12, listen to Esther's response, and it's underwhelming, at least at first. It tells us Hathach went and he told Esther everything. That must have been quite a set of information to process. A lot of data there that she's getting. He's reading the decree, and he's got it. Hathach says, here, read this. And you know, her eyes are sort of reading what's going to happen 11 months later on the 13th day of Adar, the last month of the Jewish calendar. And the Jews are going to be destroyed in all the provinces of Persia? I mean, this is outrageous. So Esther hears all of this, and then she speaks to Hathach in verse 10, the intermediary, and sends him back. Listen to her reply. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there's but one law to be put to death except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. As for me, I've not been called to come into the king these 30 days. I think we can affirm several things here. Number one, Esther is reminding Mordecai of a principle that everybody knows. The principle is you don't just traipse into the court of the king to his throne. You just don't do that. And she says, everybody knows that. Number two, the second thing to know is you have to be summoned by the king if you're going to go. Because if you just traipse before the king, what the king could do if he doesn't hold out his golden scepter, which invites you in and you get to live, otherwise you're going to die. You're going to be executed. And archaeologists have discovered statues from the days of the Persian Empire with pictures of people by a king's throne holding an axe, which they take to mean this is not an axe at the king, but axe pointed at anybody who's prepared to come at the king uninvited. All right, these weren't pictures or archaeological reliefs of people who were trying to kill the king, but people guarding the king, the presence of the king. It was a most holy place, if you will. You didn't just come marching in behind the veil. No, you were going to be killed. And so in verse 11, we also see a third thing we can affirm. Esther doesn't have confidence that she's going to be invited, that she's going to be summoned. In fact, she says, for 30 days, I haven't been summoned. This is difficult because you might imply, well, is the king done with Esther? Is that why so many weeks have gone by? And if she hasn't been called in these many weeks, is there any reason to think optimistically about this, that maybe she still has her time to come? Or should we be pessimistic about it? Maybe she hasn't been summoned these many weeks because the king is just occupied with other people, other women. So in verse 12, they told Mordecai what Esther had said. And I want us to process what her response seems to imply. Her response seems to imply, Mordecai, I know you want me to go before the king and plead, but if I show up unsummoned, I'm going to die. Though I'm not going to be able to get the words out. I'm not going to be able to have the conversation with him that you're envisioning. It's not going to work. This seems to be a rejection of Mordecai's plan. This seems to be a rejection. So Mordecai steps it up a notch, okay? In verses 13 and 14, he issues a warning for Esther, and this changes everything for her when she hears it. In verses 13 and 14, it tells us when Mordecai told them to reply to Esther these words, "Don't think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews." So let's say the day comes on the 13th day of Adar, months later, and all the Jews are being destroyed. Esther shouldn't assume she will never be found out. In fact, it may go worse for her that she concealed it all that time after all, and then ends up being disclosed by someone. In fact, Mordecai says to her, you shouldn't presume, essentially, that you're going to be safe with the path you've chosen. In verse 14, for if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" And I think people rightly see in Esther 4:14 a conviction of the Lord's providence in Mordecai's words. He has a conviction about the Lord's providence. Consider a couple things. Number one, he has said in verse 14 that relief and deliverance are going to rise for the Jews from another place. And this is because if you were a Jew who believed the law and you believed its promises and the covenants, you believed that God wasn't going to break covenant and do away with these people. Instead, he was going to keep covenant. He was going to send his Messiah. He was going to restore the line of David. All of that was going to happen. It hadn't happened yet in the days of Persia. The Messiah hadn't yet come. But Mordecai seems to believe that if all the Jews could just be destroyed in Persia, that would call into question the Lord's promises and faithfulness. And Mordecai is actually more convinced of the Lord's faithfulness than he is at Haman's designs and plot. So in verse 14, he says, "Esther, you should do something. Don't keep silent. If you keep silent, the Lord's going to act." And what I think it invites us to consider is the Lord's plans do not hinge on any one individual person in his history before Christ. There are no inexpendable people, if you will. It's not as if someone comes along and says, "Well, you know, the kingdom of the Lord wasn't doing well until I arrived. And because of my faithfulness and my courage and my obedience or whatever, the Lord's really going to get some stuff done. We're going to see these promises come to pass." That would be a very pretentious and arrogant and foolhardy attitude. None of us is the Messiah. But nonetheless, he's inviting her to consider that she should act, but even if she doesn't, the Lord's will not be thwarted. That invites a kind of freedom, I think, to consider that the burden of the kingdom of God does not rest on any individual. There is a sense in which the Lord's power and providence will bring to pass all that he has planned and all that he has willed. But notice a second element of the Lord's providence. He invites her to consider this with a question at the very end of the verse. "Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" So Esther, to this point, has concealed who she was. Up to this point, she has not followed the law of Moses, as you would expect other Jews in exile like Daniel and the three Hebrews to have obeyed. But what if she were to seize this moment? What if she were to think of this differently? Yes, she is fearful of her life. She says, "If I go before the king, everybody knows you're going to die if you're not summoned." But what if the Lord is going to use this moment? Esther has to decide who she really is. One writer points out, Esther's the only character in the story with two names. Her Hebrew name, Hadassah, and her Persian name, Esther. So at her heart, what is she really? Is she of the people of God, or is she of the people of Persia? This seems to present a kind of identity crisis, because even the people in the book of Daniel were renamed at the beginning of the book. And yet Daniel demonstrated that even though a different name was given to him, at heart he was going to be devoted to God. That's what he resolved. Now, I've argued before in prior messages to this that Esther did not do some of the things that she should have done. But this is a different moment. This is another opportunity. Here, she is going to have to make a decision at the fork in this road, because Mordecai says to her, "If you keep silent, don't think you're going to be safe. You and your father's house are going to perish." And so, here in verses 15 to 16, here is her reply to Mordecai. Her reply is a series of commands, which is interesting because up to this point, Mordecai has directed Esther what to do or not to do, and she has obeyed him, even when she was queen. It tells us in Esther 2, she still concealed her identity because she obeyed Mordecai. But here, she, in a sense, rises to the occasion that has been presented before her. And she demonstrates courage in the midst of fear. It's not because she still doesn't have reason to be concerned for her life. She doesn't know the outcome for sure. But in the face of fear, she is going to seize courage, and in verse 16 gives this command. First, she says, "Go. Gather all the Jews to be found in Susa." So in this one city. Now, of course, there are Jews throughout the Persian Empire. But in this one city, the Jews are going to be gathered. And she says, "Hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. So we know here that this collective fast is not just part of a day, and it's not even a whole day. It's 3 whole days. That's a long time to not eat or drink, and that's a lot of people to expect to do this collectively. Esther also says, I and my young women will fast also as you do. Now, we're at about 474 BC. Esther has been queen for about 5 years. We know that she still has some fear of man, given what we've just seen her resist in Mordecai's initial plan here. But nonetheless, we see here that she and her young women are going to fast as you do, which invites us to consider, who are these young women who would join in on this? And there are a couple possibilities, and I'm not sure we have to choose between them. This could mean that there were other Jewish, young, beautiful virgins who were taken years earlier, and they're all part of this group. And so Esther may be referring to those, because again, she's told Mordecai to gather the Jews and have them fast. It's unlikely that she's wanting these pagan Gentiles, in other words, to join in on this. It's also possible that Esther has been speaking of Yahweh to people who are not Jews in the place where she is. We don't know what all has been transpiring for Esther during these 5 years that she has been queen. But enough has transpired to where she's willing to make this very bold declaration and courageous conviction in just a moment. So she says, I and my young women will also fast for these 3 days, and then I will go to the king. She just declares it. I will go to him, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. She is essentially resigning herself to death if that is what comes. She doesn't know what the outcome will be, but she's going in with eyes wide open that death is definitely on the table here. In fact, death is likely. Death is probable. In Esther's mind, death may be all but guaranteed at this point. And if I perish, I perish. So in verse 17, Mordecai then went away and did everything Esther ordered him. That's different from the reverse kinds of statements we've seen elsewhere, where Esther does what Mordecai says. But here, he leaves. He's going to go gather the Jews. He's going to hold a fast, tell them to eat and drink, all the Jews in the city. And Esther has hers doing the same thing. So in verses 1 to 5 of chapter 5, here is Esther's encounter with the king. On the third day. And by the way, what other day would it most appropriately be on? The third day is a day of deliverance and intervention in multiple places throughout the Old Testament. It makes all the sense in the world that if Esther is going to have an encounter with the king that's favorable, the third day is the day to do it on, thank goodness. So in verse 1, it tells us on the third day, Esther put on her royal robes. So she's dressing the part. After all, she is queen, and she's going to come to him like, oh, in a way that not anybody else who may just be one of the young women in the kingdom could approach him as. They don't have the garments of the queen. They don't have the crown of Vashti from earlier in chapter 1, but she has them. She's got the robe, she's got the crown. And in walks Esther, the queen. And she stands in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters, while right there the king is sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. This is a dangerous moment. Esther has all but considered that death is likely, if not certain. Physically speaking, she would be weak. She has not eaten anything or drank anything for 3 days, nor have any of the other Jews. She has not been summoned for the last 30 days. So relationally, there could be some expected distance in the what you would might expect to be the natural intimacy between the husband and the wife. She has been queen for 5 years, and yet she knows that the last queen Ahasuerus had, who disregarded his command and who ignored his law, was deposed. And so here she comes to the king, and with everybody's breath held who knew about this, no doubt, in verse 2, it says the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, and she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. And that, friends, is life on the third day. That is life on the third day. When on the third day, what you would have expected is death. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. So he has seen his queen. He has invited her forward. And more than just that, in verse 3 says, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom." My goodness, this is getting better than we could have imagined. I don't think Esther's expecting this kind of reception. She's probably not going up there thinking, okay, just like according to plan, you know, he's inviting me to ask whatever I want up to half of the kingdom. Earlier she had said, if I perish, I perish. That didn't sound like a woman who was expecting the kind of generosity here. But they've been fasting for it. And no doubt the fasting would have been paired with prayer. And here, it tells us in verse 4, Esther answers, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I've prepared." This answer of Esther's surprises readers, and rightly so. Readers might validly wonder, the king has just said, whatever you ask up to half my kingdom. Why didn't she just say, spare the Jews? Why didn't she just say it? There's a few possibilities. Number one, you need to consider that time is on Esther's side for whatever she is hoping to carry out. The destruction is not scheduled a few days from then or weeks, but 11 months later. She's not having to bolt in there and in their first encounter make her opening words or request to the king this particular. In other words, the desperation is not what it might seem to be. This is not something coming immediately, but much farther down the line. But consider number two, Esther's request is a huge request because the king has already given Haman royal authority. And we find out later in the book, he cannot undo the order because of how the Persian policies work. You don't issue a decree and then say a few days later, I take that back. You know, let's roll all that back. So she would be asking the king to contradict a royally authorized edict that his promoted man Haman had issued under the king's authority. That's not a small request. That's a huge request. Number three, consider that it would be valuable and wise to make this request before more people than just her and the king alone. After all, the king has proven to be someone easily guided by whoever is in proximity to him to do what they want him to do. So while Esther needs to persuade the king, what if someone afterward comes in and undermines the request? It's actually going to be to Esther's benefit that more than just her and the king are present. In fact, it's going to work stunningly, awesomely well that Haman be present when all of this unfolds later in the book. And then fourth, consider, Esther may realize that after feasting and drinking a while, the king may be better disposed to hearing her request since he would be relaxed and content and even happy. And so readers could look at a statement like what she gave, you know, which is basically in chapter 5, verse 4, you come to a feast today. Why didn't Esther just give her request? There are several very practical possibilities, and they may all, in fact, be true. Or additional ones that we've not considered together tonight. Either way, the power in the story has shifted to Esther. And she is now the one, the mover and the shaker, in terms of the explicit events in the story. This is not in any way to diminish the providence of God behind the scene all along. In verse 5, the king agrees, bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked. So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And so here you have, just think of the scene for a moment. Who's at dinner tonight? The banquet has the king, the villain in the story, and then there's Esther, hoping, praying, having fasted that this goes in a way that will be favorable for the deliverance of the people. In verses 6 to 8, in our last part of the text tonight, we're going to look at Esther's dinner with the king and see what transpires. It tells us in verse 6, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said, resuming that prior conversation, what is your wish? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled. So all that language we've heard before, right? So this is now the second opportunity for her to say. And she says in verse 7, my wish and my request is, and the readers might say, okay, here it comes, here it comes. She's going to say, king, I need you to not destroy the Jews that this guy Haman, you know, has plotted against. But she says in verse 8, to our surprise, perhaps further surprise, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said. Now wait a second, Esther. It might make sense in one way to postpone that initial request to the dinner scene itself. But so at the dinner, you're going to invite them to another dinner? That's what you're going to do? That's exactly what she did. That's exactly what she did. But look at the wording. Look at the wording. People have drawn attention to the wording of this second invitation. Because perhaps Esther is not as confident as she is going to be that the king is going to grant this large request given who Haman is. Given what the king has authorized Haman to do. And so she words it this way in verse 8. If it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request. In other words, if you plan to grant it, if you plan this wish, this request that you're inviting me to make, if you intend to keep it, then let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them. People have noted that the wording here emphasizes she wants the king to be really sure that he's going to grant whatever she requests, and that this invitation is basically the king showing up committed to follow through. In other words, if you show up at this dinner, if you show up at this next banquet, whatever I've requested, you've come ready to fulfill that. So perhaps the wording of the second invitation, which is even stronger than the first, is the key here. By the very nature of the king showing up to this next banquet, he will be committing himself to grant whatever it is that Esther's going to ask. And she very cleverly sets it up to where Haman will be there also. Oh, and what a scene it is. I think it's just one of the best scenes in the Bible. Haman is the mastermind behind the slaughter of the Jews that's coming 11 months from now. But Esther is a mastermind as well. She is working the situation. And she is wanting to be even surer than maybe she would already partially feel. We don't know what the king would have said if she would have went ahead and asked him at the throne room. We don't know what she would have heard him say if she just asked him at the first banquet. But she is most confident that if he comes to that second banquet, he's ready to deliver on whatever I ask. So as one writer said, I like this image. Esther was playing the king like a trophy fish in the water, taking her time, not rushing to reel him in. She was carefully maneuvering him into a position where he would be virtually obligated to do whatever she asked, and he wasn't even aware he had been hooked. And I think, end quote. I think it's a good way of thinking about it. She is carefully pacing herself, reeling him in, and he won't even realize that he's hooked until the very end. All right. So this builds delay. Well, another writer said it this way. The third time is the charm in all kinds of literary accounts. And indeed, in the book of Esther, at this third scene, this third opportunity, that is when the deliverance is going to be seized. And not only that, the idea of a third is also important because Esther goes to the king on the third day. So Esther goes to the third on the third day and lives on the third day. She didn't die. She lives. And then on the third opportunity, she is going to absolutely make her request and secure the deliverance of the people. I think we have to marvel at the providence of God here. Because one scholar on the book of Esther says the outcome is not just a product of Esther's shrewdness, her cleverness. Even with all of Esther's shrewdness, this man says the king didn't have to extend his scepter. She didn't do anything to earn that. He hadn't seen her for 30 days. He didn't have to extend his scepter, but he did. He didn't have to invite her to make a request, but he did. The king didn't have to come to the banquet, but he did. The king didn't have to insist that Haman come, bring Haman quickly, as Esther has asked, but the king did. The king didn't have to agree to a second banquet, but he did. And this writer says, the reason behind all of this is just like what the book of Proverbs teaches. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord, and he turns it wherever he will in Proverbs 21:1. I think what we're witnessing here is the providence of the Lord, where the king is acting according to his will, acting according to his present desires, and yet a plan grander in scope than he could possibly imagine is unfolding and being fulfilled right before his eyes. This is a defining moment in the book. It's a defining moment because perhaps if we were concerned about Esther earlier in the story, I think we are looking at a different woman these years later, who is mustering up the kind of conviction and courage and boldness that you would hope would characterize people outside the promised land and inside. This defining moment is that if she would perish, then she will perish. Just as I alluded to earlier, though, Esther is a type of the Lord Jesus. Just like Esther, who goes in thinking about death, Jesus himself knows that the deliverance he's going to secure will not just be, if I perish, I perish, but that he will indeed perish on behalf of his people. Esther did not have to die, but Jesus did. Jesus came to give his life. And not only that, the Old Testament likes life on the third day references. Those start in the book of Genesis with Isaac, who is delivered and lives on the third day. And the greatest of all the third day deliverances is not Esther's, but the one of Jesus himself. Now, of course, Esther experienced life on the third day, having not actually died, which means Jesus' third day deliverance is even better. Because Jesus did perish, and his third day vindication came after his death. Esther was granted life from the king, but Jesus was granted resurrection life from the dead. Esther is not a perfect character, but none of the Bible characters that point forward to Jesus are perfect characters. Moses wasn't, David wasn't, Jonah wasn't. And yet, you have examples or correspondences to events in these people's lives that lead you ultimately to Christ, who is what we need and does what we need him to do. What we so desperately need him to do, but do not deserve. And so in a story like this, we can marvel at the courage and boldness of Esther. And we could pray for the Lord to give us courage, and that we would seize opportunities to stand for Christ and to speak truth and to not conceal who we are, but to be the people of God and to live out with boldness our faith in God and his never-changing promises. Because we are so convinced, even like Mordecai would say, that God's providence is at work. And we can recognize that we don't know the outcome of things, but that's okay. They didn't know how these things would necessarily turn out in terms of detail either. But their faith in God needed to be expressed, and so does ours. So there is a sense of example that we can look to, morally speaking, and draw a lesson from in terms of courage. And yet, even more so, we can marvel about how this prepares the way for Christ, who would indeed perish and live on the third day in order to deliver his people. Not from Haman, though, from something far worse. He doesn't take the gallows that Haman eventually goes to. Jesus goes to the cross to bear the cup of God's wrath for our sake, that whoever believes in him would not perish, but have everlasting life. Jesus is the true and greater Esther in this sense, who did indeed perish, and on the third day had life.